From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1948 when the Supreme Court ruled in favor of prohibiting some women from being licensed as bartenders. The case was called Gosart versus Cleary, and it upheld a Michigan law that banned female bartenders in cities with populations of 50,000 or more unless the women's fathers or husbands own the bar. Michigan state law argued that since bartending could, in their words, lead to moral or social problems for women, the state could keep them from being bartenders. That decision was later overruled. And then in 1971, the California Supreme Court took on a case of job discrimination, which led to women being allowed to bartend. Finally, similar laws began to take hold across the country. Just looking at the number of female bartenders in the U.S., the situation has changed dramatically. In the early 1900s, about 0.3% of bartenders in America were women. Today, that number is around 60%. But how does the industry rate when it comes to equal treatment and pay for female bartenders? Research shows that many women behind the bar earn about 87 cents to every dollar earned by their male counterparts, and women in the hospitality field are 5 times more likely to file sexual harassment complaints than in any other field. But efforts are underway to change all of that, and that's just a small part of the big week-long celebration, the 5th annual Rochester Cocktail Revival, kicking off next week, and there is a special emphasis with some events about women in the industry. Our guest this hour will discuss efforts to change the culture, to be more inclusive, more women in the field, and honoring their accomplishments. Plus, we'll get a preview of the upcoming event. We're going to talk trends in the cocktail world and more. So let's go ahead and welcome our guests for the hour. Evie Fanning is the owner of Cheshire. It's a cocktail bar in the South Wedge. Welcome back to the program, Evie.
Thanks for having me.
Chuck Sarankoski is founder of the Rochester Cocktail Revival, co-owner and beverage director of Good Luck and Cure, and co-founder of Boomtown Table. Chuck, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Evan.
And also here is Kat Archer, bartender at Radio Social and coordinator for the Eastman Drinking in Color event that's coming up. Kat, welcome to you as well.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
I saw Evie nodding a lot during that introduction. So this is one of those times where, I mean, I'm sure I would have guessed that there was discrimination in bartending behind the bar, but I didn't realize until we kind of dug into before this show just how severe. And you're just nodding away going, oh, yes.
Yeah. As somebody who frequents bars and works at a bar and owns a bar, unfortunately, I have to agree with the sad statistics.
just a sad thing that I shouldn't be surprised about. But let's talk a little bit about the broad overview of the cocktail revival, because if you don't know what it is, this is year 5, Chuck, is that right?
This is the 5th year, yeah.
And you've got 16 establishments that I read participating, 50 events or so, more than that?
Oh yeah, we're gonna actually fluctuate those statistics. We've got we've got over 70 events, and we have 23 participating bars this year.
Look how outdated my research is.
Oh, that's okay. it's confusing and it fluctuates, but we have 23 participating bars over 25 venues that will produce between 65 and 75 events when we're all through.
And there's a couple of things that I want to note off the bat, because mostly this is a celebration of Rochester as a cocktail scene, the growth in the industry, education, if you want to learn about a wide range of things. But you're also sensitive to the fact that people are going to be drinking at these events, and you got a couple of things to help people. You got an Uber code and an RCR shuttle. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's right. First of all, it's nothing that the RCR invented, and it's no stranger to the community, but Uber and Lyft are here, and we specifically have an Uber code set up to allow assist people to safely travel from venue to venue. You can see the details of redeeming the Uber code for a discounted ride at rochestercocktailrevival.com. In the same spot, you'll also find some information about the shuttle that we run, thanks to sponsorship support from Right Beverage, that runs Friday and Saturday between 8 of the neighborhoods that a lot of the bars are located in. So we definitely emphasize spending the week going around to as many bars as you can do, but in a safe manner, and certainly not behind the wheel if you are choosing to imbibe.
All right, so starting next Tuesday, May 1st, the Rochester Cocktail Revival, and running through Sunday the 6th. And Chuck, you're always on here with your co-founders after just about everything is booked up. What's the case this year?
Yeah. Well, the... There are events that have smaller capacity, like dinners and things. I'm going to go ahead and plug all of them. If you're interested in going out to dinner, check again rochestercocktailrevival.com. You'll find a easy to navigate list of events that'll describe where there are dinners and parties at again those 23 different bars. There are also quite a bit of tickets available still for the highlighted events, which include the George Eastman Museum Drinking in Color event on Wednesday the 2nd, as well as the Rochester Cocktail Revival Gala on Thursday the 3rd, and of course, sort of unlimited tickets for the awesome Spirit Tasting Spectacular in the morning of May 5th. It's on Saturday morning at the Metropolitan Tower.
All right, so RochesterCocktailRevival.com for the list of more than 70 events, not 50. Trust Chuck and not me on that. And more, just about 24 different venues. So it's all starting this coming Tuesday if you want to check it out there. And don't blame me if you want to go to an event that is already sold out, because you should be looking ahead.
There'll be another one. Choose another one. There's enough there.
There's a lot going.
I promise.
There's a lot going. And some of them, by the way, start late morning and in the afternoon. And there's discussions. And we're going to talk about some of that. Let me go back to our introduction, looking at just the rate of sexual harassment claims in this field, 5 times more than any other field, women in hospitality. And I wonder how Kat and Abby, first of all, feel about that. Kat, does that surprise you that the harassment claims are so high in this field?
No, not at all. I think the thing to remember is
that... Do me a favor, just get a little closer. Grab that mic. There you go. Okay. I want to make sure I hear you. Go ahead.
In our industry, we work with alcohol. It lowers people's inhibitions, and I think that that's probably the key factor is when people have had a few drinks or men have a few drinks, they just would behave
usually
in a way...
Usually men.
Not always. They just would behave in a way that they normally wouldn't probably, or say things, or that just wouldn't happen in a lot of other places. A lot of people aren't allowed to drink at work. So it's not an excuse, but I think that it kind of explains why it's so much higher in our industry.
Do you, though, you must occasionally have some men who haven't even started drinking who will say something?
There's always a few bad apples.
Okay. And do you think now, you know, we are 6 months post the Harvey Weinstein story in the Times in the so-called Me Too era, does that at least put a little bit of a different feeling when someone is out of line at the bar? Is it more likely that someone near him is going to say something? Is it more likely that they're not going to say something at all, or that the person's not going to say something harassing at all? Or do you think nothing has really changed in 6 months?
I think that men are generally more self-conscious because of that, because of the visibility, because, you know, women have that platform on social media. They have that voice now. So definitely the awareness is raised. But I'm never surprised when I see it, because alcohol changes how people behave. And again, once you've had a few drinks, you're going to do things you probably normally wouldn't do. So not surprised if I still see it these days.
I also don't want to color most of the customers at these establishments with a broad or a bad brush, because my guess is most of the customers at Radio Social and Good Luck and Cure and Cheshire are lovely. Yes, Abby?
Yeah, most of them really are. I think still socially it is permissible to behave in this way in a bar. Like you said in the introduction, it's traditionally a male domain. This was a place where men could go to get away from the women, the wives, the social rules, the niceties that they were expected to uphold, maybe in the home or in other places in mixed company. So they'd go to the bar to behave, you know, as men will when nobody's watching, I guess. So, you know, in the past very few years, we've started letting women in, but we haven't entirely changed that culture yet, where it's not just a boys' club anymore.
Are you feeling anything different since really the start of the Me Too sort of movement and era, even in recent months?
I'm not sure. Like you said, we're very fortunate in that most of our customers are really good people and have good manners and are polite. So it's not like the overwhelming majority of our customers talk down to us and mistreat us. And,
yeah.
You know, so I can't say that there's been a noticeable shift from what I've seen in the past few months.
How do you handle a harassing situation?
That's a tough question, because they're subtle, right? Nobody comes up to me and says, hey, go sleep with me. You know, like, that's not what happens. But, you know, you'll get a compliment that sometimes is not appropriate, that's pushing the limit of what is okay and not okay to talk about publicly. And depending on how far that goes, I might try to joke, or I might try to put a person in their place, or sometimes I've asked people to leave and I've told them that I'll no longer be serving them.
But not often?
Not often.
Okay.
No.
Kat, what about you?
I'd say the same, and it has to be taken on a case-by-case basis on how someone's behaving. I think humor is really great to deflect that kind of behavior. You can kind of throw it right back at them, and they'll enjoy it, and everyone's still having a good time, which is ultimately, you know, what we're there to do is create a hospitable environment. There are times when you have to get management involved, you know, to really set a boundary, but that doesn't happen that often. And I'm lucky that management is really supportive where I work, and you know, they've always backed me up in those situations.
Now, Chuck, someone who's been in running restaurants for how long now?
10 years.
About 10 years.
Yeah.
Is it often that you feel like you're called upon to help or to sort of witness a situation like this, or, you know, someone who's working with you or for you is telling you about harassment of some kind? Is it not very often? What would you say?
It's not very often, because I think that in the genre of establishments that my businesses exist, and in those of my colleagues, again, we're not going to, you know, paint Rochester as being, you know, one sort of bars and the other sort of bars, but mm-hmm. in you know, higher, maybe finer dining, the atmosphere can be a little bit better. It does happen seldom, and it is our job, and I think that it happens more seldom because we establish a policy from the very beginning. If you are a customer and you choose to treat one of our staff members in a way because they of their gender or their skin color or any other reason or their sexual orientation, you're not going to be served in our establishment. I've had to exercise that rule at everywhere except for the newest place, just because it's the newest, at least one time. I've asked people to leave. It doesn't make me a hero, but it does mean that when you do have the status that I have, which is a white male in a position of power, meaning as a boss, I feel a responsibility to be a good steward towards those causes. And I definitely had conversations with female employees before when there's times where I thought a guest said something off color to my perception. It's not for me to decide what makes someone uncomfortable, but it is for me and my management teams to make sure that that employee knows that she has the protection or the support of the whole management team or the whole rest of the staff to simply, you know, not be have to serve that customer or to be, you know, protected or ask the person to leave. So those are sort of the policies. And again, they're not perfect, and, you know, we learn as we go, but that's definitely the mission that we try to establish.
Okay. You want to add to that?
Yeah, there's a subtler side to this also. We're kind of talking about the blatant sort of, you know, somebody comes in and is inappropriate, and so we ask them to leave. And like Chuck has said, in all of these places, anytime I've witnessed that happening, I've seen the management handle it appropriately, you know, and that's that. But outside of that, there are much more like microaggression types of things happening that are not illegal and not necessarily offensive to the point where you would stop serving a person. But I get a lot of comments like, when is the bartender going to be here? You know, when I'm behind the bar and they're waiting for my colleague who's a man to come back. Or I offer to make somebody a drink and they'll say, I'm gonna wait for him to make my cocktail. There are a lot of comments like that. There are comments like, if somebody introduces me as the owner of a bar, I'll get comments about, oh, so you're one of the owners. Whereas, again, the bartender who works with me frequently gets asked, oh, are you the owner? So I think that there's just an assumption, there's an attitude, there's still this pervasive notion that this is not where women belong, and this is not where women are in charge, this is not necessarily where women are empowered, and we have to take kind of more subtle steps to change that as well.
How do we change it?
Yeah, good, I'm glad you asked. Well, I think deliberate hiring is one thing. We need to see more women cocktail bartenders. I think we see a lot of bartenders in a different kind of bartending arena, but still in the cocktail bars, it's mostly men. It's mostly, you know, suspenders and that old-timey sort of look. And part of that is a throwback to that time in history and in culture where it was all men. But as with everything else, we have to update that as we engage in it today. And so we have to make an effort to hire women. We have to make an effort to train them, to make them, you know, to make sure that they're doing the job as professionally as anybody else. We have to make sure that we promote them and show them in ways that are not objectifying them, that we have appropriate dress codes, for example, and that we're vigilant about the way people speak to one another and treat our staff.
There is an event with the Cocktail Revival, 3 p.m. next Thursday. It's a week from today, at the Spirit Room. right here on State Street. And the event's titled Minimizing Marginalization in Hospitality. It's going to be a panel discussion about inclusion in the restaurant industry, about challenges faced and how we can do better. So Evie addressing some of that. And Chuck, as I look at your schedule, so you've got Minimizing Marginalization in Hospitality. You've got an event called Glass Ceilings, Wooden Bars next Wednesday at 1:30 at the new Bar Bantam. In which there's going to be a history of women who pioneered modern mixology. Tell me a little bit about how the founders of the Cocktail Revival decided to make sure this programming included events like this and why you're doing that this year.
Well, we certainly try to include or introduce seminar topics that are of the moment, that need to be talked about right now. And that's been, you know, shrubs in the past, or, you know, this year, history of the mint julep on Derby Day and all that good stuff. But obviously, social issues as well. And I want to, again, I'm going to say this carefully because I don't want to pretend that I have the same experience as my colleagues here sitting at the table. But again, in my experience being a boss, the contributions of women in management roles to any of my staffs are, I'm going to just go ahead and say, more valuable than the males in the same roles. I mean, we've always, from the time I worked at Java's, my boss was a woman for many, many years. I've hired, you know, I really like to look at our programs as being inclusive as far as hiring. Again, it's not because they're perfect or we're heroes in that way, but again, we looked for the seminar, the Glass Ceiling Seminar, because we want to point out that some of the founders and some of the pillars of the craft cocktail movement, Ivy Mix and Julie Reiner and some of the founders of New York's, you know, first cocktail bars, Pegu Club, et cetera, Lynette Marrero starting Speed Rack, they were not guys. They were women that really were the cause of this movement and part of it from the beginning. And I think it's not that it didn't exist. People didn't talk about it and it gets forgotten. So we need to make sure everyone understands that. I mean, look at the on May 6th, I'm going to try not to stutter here. Sorry. On May 6th, the Barroom Battle Royale has a competition that you've judged before, Evan, that you were sober the whole time during. It is called the Bar Ninja Competition. It's a speed competition. It's modeled after Speed Rack, which is a all-female bartender competition started by, again, Lynette Monerero. So there's definitely a contribution of women being sort of the cornerstones of this industry. And, of course, we want to highlight that as well as we should, because it's there.
All right. So in our second half hour, we're going to kind of dive more into some of the other events, and we're going to welcome a guest by a phone. Jason Wilson, the author of Booze Hound, On the Trail of the Rare, the Obscure, and the Overrated in Spirits, is going to be on the phone with us. People have asked me if I was ever going to write another book, and I always say no. Jason Wilson wrote the two that I would have written otherwise, his book on spirits and his forthcoming book on wine. So thanks a lot, Jason. But he's going to join us coming up here. Before we do that, let me just kind of close the loop on a couple of things here. Kat, do you feel that the Cocktail Revival itself is as inclusive as you want? Are you happy with the programming and sort of how it has set up?
Absolutely. I've never felt, well, I am new to Rochester, new to the Cocktail Revival, but since I've been here, there's so many amazing female bartenders who get, and bar owners who get showcased, and there's a lot of events, you know, about inclusivity, and yeah, I've been pleasantly surprised, not being from this town, not really having known what to expect, just the level of professionalism and the amount of, you know, female colleagues that are here.
Okay. So, Evie, how do you feel about it?
I think the optics still could get better. I would still love to see, you know, fewer women in lingerie and rubber bras and torn miniskirts in our advertising. And I'd like to see more women and men bartenders treated and spoken about, not based on their sex or their gender. And I don't say this as something that, you know, other people have imposed on me. As one of the founders, I'm totally responsible for making that change, which I think is part of the reason we're talking about it. It is a long, long tradition in the industry, in the history of our country, in the history of the world, that there's a difference, and I think an unfortunate one, in the way we celebrate men and women, even when they're doing the same job. And I would like to do more to minimize that.
Okay. Chuck, you want to respond to some of what Evie just said there? Do you think there's a little bit of a over-sexualized culture to the way it's promoted at all? Anything you're uncomfortable with?
I am going to take a risk and say no, because our promotions this year don't involve actual people. They're photo illustrations of photo illustrations of drinks with people performing athletic activities. We did set up a video to promote the festival, and we asked everyone to wear what he or she please or what they wish to wear. But I don't know. No, I don't think so. But I also am not the person that's as sensitive to that.
Okay. So a little bit of disagreement in some of the co-founders. And, you know, Evie, do you at least think that this year things are a little bit different?
I think it gets better every year, honestly. Okay. I really do. This is year five. And I think that we do a better job every year, both with the programming and with the advertising and with the inclusivity and with the kinds of things that we do and the kinds of things that we celebrate. So yeah, absolutely. I think, and I'm very proud of that, and I'm happy to see it continue going in that direction. So I don't disagree with Chuck on that.
Here's an email from a listener named Deb, who says, just wondering for the male on your panel, that would be Chuck is his name, as a male who runs establishments, how do you personally ensure that you don't have unconscious bias against women? She says, I think some men don't recognize that they might take women that they don't take women as seriously as men. I was recently having drinks with friends and was approached by a male bar owner, and my friend and I both knew him, but he only acknowledged my friend, and it was rude and offensive to me as a woman. I don't think the owner realized that. What can men in power do to recognize this unconscious bias?
Men in power can be aware and wake up and read current events and learn from the mistakes of others, and they can think about their mothers, their sisters, their wives, their daughters, and hopefully hold all women to the respect they have for those people. Because being a brother of two sisters with a strong mother and two grandmothers I admire, and having a teenage daughter, makes me think about all of their experiences when I think of how the horrible stories I think I hear about women experiencing in this industry and beyond. So I think as bosses, whether if we do happen to be white males, we need to be very aware and be stewards of good culture. And it starts by treating people equally and treating them with respect, regardless of their gender or any other condition.
All right. And let me just read from a local female bartender who says, as someone, a woman who works in a bar, I definitely feel like my male managers and bosses have my back in terms of outright harassment from customers. But unless there are more female owners and managers, I don't feel protected against sexism within my own organization, like when my boss makes inappropriate comments, or when I'm required or encouraged to wear a specific outfit, or when I'm required to make or pour a drink that has a name that is blatantly sexist. That comes from a bartender. What do you make of that? Would you draw a line at things you may have to wear or certain drinks that you don't feel like are appropriate, whether if they're named or something sexualized?
I'm going to be a little all over the map with this response. I'm thinking a lot of things at once right now. In terms of what women wear, I don't care if you want to bartend in a bikini, if that's what you want to wear. You should be able to wear it and be taken seriously. I don't think anyone should be pressured to wear anything that's overly sexualized, but if that's what a woman wants to wear, makes her feel comfortable.
But a big difference between if you want to versus if that's a requirement.
Absolutely. I just want to make sure that no one's shaming anybody for expressing themselves in a certain way or being a certain way, because I think that female sexuality is something that should be appreciated, not suppressed, right? So I just want to put that out there. When we're talking about what women wear, there's also that perspective.
Yeah, sure.
That Eddie? I hold.
On the flip side of that, I agree with you completely. We also don't need to pressure women to put on ties and suspenders. You know, right. It's okay to be a woman, look like a woman, dress yes. professionally, look nice, but not be overly sexualized or desexualized.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Before we bring in Jason Wilson, who's coming to the Rochester Cocktail Revival himself, let me ask our guests, what they are most excited about on the menu this year. And Chuck always cops out and he lists like seven things, but that's fine because you're excited about the whole week of events that start next Tuesday. But
the whole week.
Yeah, I know. But give me two or three that really stand out to you, that either for the theme or what's exciting to you.
The 2018 Rochester Cocktail Revival Gala, 6 to 9 p.m. on May 3rd at Artisan Works, is going to be a riot. Very, very cool. It's an Ocean's 11 theme. There will be an aerial artist, a jazz band, a DJ, casino games, three bars, all supported by the portfolio of Brown-Forman. The George Eason Museum event, Drinking in Color, I gotta imagine this plays well to the audience listening right now. We're in cocktail form going to investigate cinematic history and the hand coloring of film slides and how that translates to cocktails. That's on Wednesday, May 2nd. And then finally, I'll say one for all of the bartenders, the Barroom Battle Royale, the climax of the whole festival, on Sunday, May 6th at 5 p.m. at Radio Social. Two bar competitions, samplings, tastings, revelry, raucousness, and respect.
So there's that was good. You limited it to three, but RochesterCocktailRevival.com for the full list of more than 70 events. What are you most excited about, Kat?
Definitely the Drinking in Color event. That's the one that I'll be organizing, so I have to put that one out there.
Sure.
I also hear that there's a luau and a pig roast happening at some point this week, and I can't remember which bar it's happening at. Chuck?
Ox and Stone.
Ox and Stone.
So Alexander Street.
Okay. All right. Abby Fanning.
I can plug my own stuff.
Please
right?
do.
It's obnoxious.
No, it's not.
I'm throwing you a softball after half an hour.
All of
serious
the stuff
discussion.
That they said. Yeah. Yes. And also, we've got a skirts and suits event on Friday where people can dress up, and we're going to have a photo booth, and we're going to have a DJ from the jazz station playing music. And then on Saturday, I'm really excited about our comparison of Japanese whiskey with American whiskey. So we're going to kind of put those side by side and talk about them and sample them and make some decisions about that.
All right. I'll warn you again. You've heard a lot about events that are happening. But if they are ticketed events, check it out now. Or don't blame me. RochesterCocktailRevival.com. You want to check it out. It's the fifth annual. And you're hearing from co-founders Chuck Sarankoski, Abby Fanning. Chuck's founder of Rochester Cocktail Revival and co-owner and beverage director of Good Luck and Cure, co-founder of Boomtown Table. Is there a third that I don't know about that you said your newest venue? Is there another that I don't know about?
I am the food and beverage director for Radio Social and then also for Bar Bantam.
Oh, Bar Bantam. Okay. See?
Yeah.
That's a really cool looking place, by the way.
Thanks.
Yeah. I was there last weekend. Abby Fanning, owner of Cheshire, is here as well. Kat Archer, bartender at Radio Social, coordinator for the Eastman Drinking in Color event that you just heard described. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back and welcome Jason Wilson to the program, the author of Booze Hound, On the Trail of the Rare, the Obscure, and the Overrated in Spirits. And he's going to be also talking about a new book that I wish I had written, but he's much smarter than me, so we'll talk to him about that next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections. This is one of the biggest seller's markets ever in the local housing stock. That's according to real estate agents and trackers of the industry. And yeah, it seems like they always want to boost their own numbers, but really, it is not a buyer's market. We're going to talk about why and what might change that. Then second hour, teaching mental health in schools. Talk with you Friday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. One thing that the Rochester Cocktail Revival has done all 5 years, and more so I think this year than ever, is they bring in experts in the industry who are not from Rochester. They bring in authors, people who have really tried to understand the industry, either written everything from how-to to histories of to our next guest, Jason Wilson, who we'll say hello to in a minute. Chuck Sarankoski, why don't you give me a little bit of an overview on the people you're bringing in for the 2018 edition?
Sure. So we as you said, we bring in Jason Wilson. We're bringing in spirits historian David Wondrich, film director Steven Soderbergh comes to Rochester for the Cocktail Revival. Jackie Summers from New York, Alan Katz from New York, Lynette Marrero, Megan Dorman from New York City come in. We also bring in Don Cazentre from Syracuse, as well as Chris Cardone, the Diageo World Class National Champion, joins us for some seminars and events as well. So a lot of an educational and exploratory sort of dimension to the Cocktail Revival. really work to, with the support of our sponsors, bring in some awesome speakers to contribute to all the conversations.
Well, one of them is Jason Wilson, who's on the line with us now, the author of the book Booze Hound, On the Trail of the Rare, the Obscure, and the Overrated in Spirits. And he's got a book forthcoming as well. Both of the kinds of books that would have been, I say, Jason, you know, I would have loved to have written these books, but you took them already. So congratulations to you on the success already of Booze Hound, and thanks for taking the time to join the program.
Sure. Yeah, Godforsaken Grapes, the new book, just came out Tuesday, in fact. So
It's 2 days old. That's like
2 days old.
It's like having a baby, man. You probably haven't slept.
I haven't slept, no.
Well, congratulations on that as well. So can you do me a favor? Can you tell our audience what both are about? Start with Booze Hound and then Godforsaken Grapes.
Okay, so Booze Hound was published in 2010, and it was sort of my journey through, at the time, which was the world of rare and obscure spirits. I think now, you know, 7 or so years later, a lot of the spirits I wrote about aren't that obscure anymore. They're kind of found in every cocktail bar in the United States. But back then, you know, this was the beginning of the cocktail renaissance, you know, and it was kind of chronicling that from, you know, the late 2000s when people were learning how to make cocktails again. And so, you know, it was a travel, memoir, recipes, a real kind of shaggy dog of a book, and went, you know, France, Italy, Peru, you know, all around the world, and talking about spirits.
And the forthcoming book, or the book that's not forthcoming anymore, the two-day-old book.
I'm still on this, you know, strange and obscure beat. It just so happens that right now this is about wine grapes, and so this is a travelogue through the world of grapes you've probably never heard of and may not be able to pronounce. So, and the kind of the premise of this book is that there are 1,400 wine grapes known to exist in the world, and sadly, though, 80% of our wine is made from only 20 of those grapes. So we'll explore the other 1,380 in this book.
What are a few examples that maybe that we will see a little bit here and there on a menu, or some that stand out real quick?
Well, I mean, there's always a spectrum of obscurity. I think, you know, sort of not so obscure but hard to pronounce would be like Grüner Veltliner or Blaufränkisch from Austria. And then there becomes sort of like a little more obscure, which might be like, Fair Servadou from Southwest France. And then there's like totally obscure, like Chisi or Riccettatelli or Saporavi from the Republic of Georgia, or Himbertshaw or Guas from the Alps of Switzerland, where there probably is like an eighth of an acre grown of this grape in the world.
Well, Jason's had a chance not just to write these stories of obscure cocktails or obscure wine grapes, but also to travel and to experience them. And I want to go back to your 2010 book, because that's an interesting little snapshot that you write this in 2010. The scene's really exploded in the last decade. And you talk about what used to seem maybe obscure when you're writing this book that comes out in 2010 to feeling a decade later more mainstream. What's an example in the cocktail world?
Well, like, for instance, there's a chapter on Pisco. I think, you know, it's a pretty old hat for most people that are into the cocktail scene now. Calvados, something, you know, that was really off the map that people now know more about. Even, you know, even at that time, you know, really, really good tequila was still not like a mainstream, you know, pleasure at that time. You know, it was, I mean, I guess Patron was just kind of coming on, but I mean, you know, like really high-end tequila was still kind of a mystery or a little bit off the radar. So, I mean, you can see how far we've come. I mean, Mezcal is something that was like totally obscure, you know, 10 years ago, and now everybody professes to be an expert in Mezcal.
Well, let me ask, I'll ask you then, and then we'll ask everyone at the table here. When people want to know sort of what is hot and, you know, there's usually a drink of the moment. I can't believe the last Christmas shopping season how many Moscow Mule items. It was like the moment of the Moscow Mule, and everyone's going to, you know, maybe die of drinking copper mugs. Actually, I'm not a scientist. I'm mostly kidding. I don't know how that works. But what's the moment right now as you see it, Jason?
The moment right now? I've been thinking about this a lot. I think the moment may be something beyond cocktails, like neat spirits, like rediscovering how nice it is to have a really nice spirit in a glass with maybe need or maybe one or two ice cubes. Like maybe that would be the next frontier of this, you know, maybe not cocktails. I don't know.
I was reading MFK Fisher, who loved vermouth, and a friend said, people just drink just vermouth? Like just vermouth? And I said, yeah.
Yeah, occasionally.
MFK Fisher loved drinking just vermouth. Abby Fanning, what's the moment right now as you see it? And by the way, do you agree with what you just heard from Jason?
I like it. I hadn't thought of that, but I do, and I'm gonna run with that one more step farther and say that's basically classic cocktails when you just season a spirit. So not a ton of ingredients, not anything super complicated, you know, like we've been seeing in this movement where people get really creative and introduce new ingredients and lots of ingredients. Maybe now we're simplifying and paring it down. So like a good old fashioned is just pretty much a glass of bourbon that's just seasoned properly to bring out the flavor rather than mask it. So I'm thinking maybe, because that's what I like to drink, that's maybe where we're headed. I've definitely been seeing more of a consciousness of being sustainable and green and just being aware of that stuff. So like plastic straws are out, for example. You know, we're just going to drink straight from the glass now.
Interesting.
It's going to be great.
Interesting. Oh, that's cool. Kat Archer, what are you seeing?
You've already touched upon a few things. I was going to say drinking vermouth straight or on the rocks is definitely a classic way. People used to just drink vermouth as it was, so we're doing that again. Amaro and Amari are still having their big moment, but people are now doing that with club soda. I personally like Pesubio and soda. It's kind of a herby, blueberry, Italian liqueur, and it's really nice and refreshing. So that's really popular at the moment. But yeah, I agree with you. Going back to a cleaner, more simplistic style of drinking as opposed to trying to see which crazy ingredients you can make work together in a glass.
And Chuck Sarankowski, what are you seeing?
I'm going to go ahead and just be like third rail and talk about cocktails and say we started by talking about wine and then saying we'll just drink spirits without. We go back to cocktails, you know, the celebration of a properly mixed drink in a great bar amongst great friends. That's still my favorite. But Fortaleza Neat would be just fine for me, too.
Okay. Jason, I just got you for about 90 seconds more, so I will ask you, as someone who I know you travel a lot, and you've been to a lot of cities, Rochester Francis itself is having a really good cocktail scene, and it does. It really does. It's been really neat. It's been really cool to see the growth of it here. When you've got a short amount of time in a city like Rochester, do you try to figure out what the scene's like? Do you have to focus on your event? What's the game plan?
No. I'm going to be there for 2 days. I want to see what the scene's like for sure. I mean, I've not really spent much time in Rochester, so yeah, I'm excited to see what the scene is. I hear good things too.
What are the one or two best cocktail cities in the country right now?
Oh, I mean, I think I always have to say New Orleans.
Yeah.
Always. I mean, that's, and beyond that, oh, I don't know. Since I live near, no, I would say Philadelphia since that's where I live near, but no, I don't think so because of our state monopoly. So let's just say Portland, Oregon. How about that?
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, I want to thank you for taking the time, Jason, and we will see you here once again.
Yeah.
The new book is called What and Where? You can get it everywhere. You can get it on Amazon and everywhere else, but what's the new book?
Oh, the new book is called Godforsaken Grapes.
Godforsaken Grapes, and his book Booze Hound, On the Trail of the Rare, the Obscure, and the Overrated in Spirits.
And we'll see you at our brandy panel on Saturday the 5th, I believe, right?
Yeah.
Yes, Saturday the 5th during the Spirit Tasting Spectacular at the Metropolitan Tower.
At the Metropolitan Tower. See you here. Thank you, Jason.
All right, thanks.
All right, so that's Jason Wilson, and just one example of some of the events and people you can meet at the Rochester Cocktail Revival, rochestercocktailrevival.com, for a list of events, how to get tickets. They'll take you day by day, which is nice, and they'll take you through the day events, the night events, and the late night events. So every day is a little bit different and a lot of different ideas there. And we've got a few minutes left with our guests here. So Chuck, I like how you're fighting back for cocktails because it is the cocktail revival.
You know, that's why you brought me here. I mean, you want to talk about beer, we could
you know.
I will say, having been to Bar Bantam, there was a drink on the menu with the word bees in it. I don't remember what the, not because I was drinking heavily, just I didn't order it. I don't remember. A friend ordered a drink.
Bees for breakfast.
Bees for breakfast.
It's
really good.
It's a twist. It's a twist on a bee's knees cocktail. Gin sour with honey syrup.
All right, so really lovely little concoction there.
Yeah.
Is that an example of just putting a small twist on something like a bee's knees, simple, popular? How do you approach creating a menu like that?
Sure. So that cocktail was not created by me, but one of our opening bartenders. So I don't know where the inspiration comes from, but you know, to speak to Jason's point or where trends are in this industry, it builds immensely upon consumers being educating themselves and discovering new things and having the same thirst that bartenders do. It's not quite, doesn't always quite catch up to it, but we want to discover new stuff. So we're going to be fascinated from tequila to mezcal to Amari to vermouths to fortified wines. I mean, the drinking customer knows the difference between a fortified wine and an aromatized wine now is like almost rivals what I know about it. You know, there's just people that are really, really geek out on this stuff and they like to celebrate the culture. So good beers, great wines, great spirits, good cocktails. It's all part of running a bar. It's all part of the cocktail revival. I'm going to go ahead and plug the kitchens too that are behind all these great bars.
Yeah.
Some of our restaurants obviously have kitchens. Some of our bars do not. But the cocktail revival seeks to showcase restaurant culture, bar culture all across the city. So a lot of cool things to be aware of and a lot of great ways to experience them throughout this week, from an educational to a celebratory aspect.
So I want to hit one question on the kitchen aspect there that Chuck just brought up. And it's this idea that we have to pair everything. In the wine world, there's way too much pressure on, well, what are you going to drink with it? And I wonder in the cocktail world if, because there are pairing events, and I think that's a lot of fun, but I also think that we can get overly pedantic about it. And I want to know how you find sort of a balance and a medium. I'll start with you, Evie. I mean, should we fuss over what we're pairing?
We should eat great food and we should drink great drinks, and that will always go together. Especially if there are also people that we enjoy that we're sharing
this stuff with. But can we make mistakes? Can we make mistakes?
I really don't think so. I mean, there are things that traditionally go well together in terms of food and drinks, and so there are certain foods that will highlight certain aspects of a spicy drink or a sweet drink or a refreshing kind of citrusy drink. So there are some that will really shine when they're paired with something else, but you can't go wrong. If you have a good cocktail and you have great food, it's going to be great.
Okay.
So I'll
ask you, Kat. I remember there was a cartoon I saw where a man's getting ready to cut into a plate of meat, and a woman is bringing him a glass of wine, and he's saying, "White wine? You mean this is fish?" So, you know, it's like we can only drink something with something. How do you feel about it in the cocktail world?
I think that when it comes to pairing, the way my brain works, and I really enjoy like formulas, so I want to know these things, and I think it's really interesting. But I think it doesn't matter because food and drink are things that you enjoy simultaneously, but kind of separately.
I was hoping you would guys say there's one cocktail with one dish that's amazing, and it's X. But
okay.
It sounds like we're obsessing too much.
Well, bacon and bourbon.
Bacon and bourbon. That's good. Smokiness of both there. Yeah. Bacon and bourbon. You were going to say what?
Anything with acid. And if you have something like a fatty kind of food, I think champagne is great with everything. You can't go wrong with champagne. So bubbles are wonderful. But yeah, if it has like a bee's knees would be a good cocktail because it's light, it's refreshing. A lot of acid pairs well with food. That's why you drink Pinot Noir. So I think that'd be a good call.
Okay, check.
I think when the pairings, there's three kind of aspects. You can be as simple and obvious as we're going to glaze this cut of protein with the bourbon that we're serving alongside it. We can be overly cerebral and think about the artichokes and the finger limes that are in this dish folds in with the aspects of the tequila that we're serving it with. Or you can do, and I think this is where cocktails really shine through, you can look at the creative aspect of being a bartender or the introduce levity in it and do something like we're having a Casamigos dinner, which is a tequila, and there's a hip-hop group called Migos, and they have a song called Stir Fry. So we'll pair a Casamigos cocktail with a stir fry. And why doesn't that work? That sounds That sounds hilarious to me.
I think you have an idea for an event now.
Yeah, I think so. We got to rewrite. Throw those. If you have a cocktail revival program, throw it out. We're going to reprint it. We've got to introduce a new event. Don't throw it out. Look through it.
Do you agree with Jason's point on mezcal tequila? And do you agree with me that Cuervo ruined tequila for way too many Americans who go to college and then think that there's no such thing as good tequila?
Yeah, sure. I mean, gin, I drank a bottle of gin with a friend at a patio table in one night, and I didn't drink gin for a decade after that. I mean, you know, you have some boneheaded experience when you're young. You can ruin just about anything.
Yeah.
There's a tidal wave of interest in agave spirits and agave to listeners. Obviously, we mean tequila and mezcal and reyesa and all kinds of other cool things that you can make out of those cacti. But the point is that, you know, once people become interested in it and they learn all the dimensions of the aspect, I think we've talked about this in years past, the sky's the limit with your appreciation for it. And it's just not going to go away the same way whiskey's not going to go away, because all the different expressions of terroir that can be sort of showcased with a good quality tequila are going to shatter any of your notions about Cuervo. And if you like Cuervo, great. Good for you.
Yeah, I shouldn't have been that guy, though. That's the part of me that goes back to the first year we had this conversation. I asked everybody, what's the drink that people order that you want to kick them out of the bar for ordering? And I think you all said Appletinis, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Cat's laughing. No? Yeah. Will you make an Appletini for somebody?
I will make someone anything they want to drink.
Anything they want to drink. That's what everybody always says now. You were bold enough the first year to give me an answer, and now you all cop out and say anything's fine.
Yeah. You had to take a stand at the beginning to show people what this was all about. When Good Luck opened in 2008, we almost didn't have shot glasses, which would have been stupid, but because there's so much wanted to get away from things. Cheshire makes good stands like that. They make one cocktail at a time. They like make things they have a very stoic and steadfast way.
He's flexing for the people who can't watch.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Oh, that's right.
He's always flexing.
Yeah. If you only knew.
I'm gonna go and say I
agree that this is a service industry. We are there for the customer. If you want to drink an Appletini, I'm not gonna make that because I don't have apple pucker and I won't buy apple pucker. But I will make a cocktail that will be greenish, that will be sweet and sour, that will be delicious, but it is going to use top shelf liquor. That's where I draw the line.
Okay. Can I take back my answer?
You want to endorse that answer?
You
will approximate an apple tea?
I thought there were apples in an apple tea.
I'm actually okay with an apple tea. That doesn't bother me. It's Fireball. Someone will sip an apple teeny, but when you have these like really sticky sweet shots, you know, it kind of takes away from what I do as someone who mixes things together. And we don't carry Fireball where I work, so I feel like I have to say that.
And I'm just going to go ahead and I'm going to sort of cop out and say what the whole panel said, which is also, I don't mean to be condescending or pedantic. And if you love Cuervo, that's great. I just had a bad experience or two. And like Chuck said, anything can be ruined by a bad experience. So, some people can't drink Pinot Noir because they had a bad experience. I mean, it's just certain things. But so we don't mean to sort of condescend. In our last few minutes, I want to ask our guests about a point that a friend raised recently. And it's one of the smartest people in terms of understanding food and wine and drink that I have met. And he's really gotten into cocktails. And he said, you know, for a while, wine was more interesting because I could connect wine to place. I could travel the world. I could feel like I'm connected to a place. And I felt like cocktails can be great, but you can make it anywhere, and I'm not really connected to it. And he said he traveled to some of the really cool scenes in New Orleans, in New York City. He met people making things he didn't see made elsewhere. And now he can try to approximate it at home, but he feels like he's brought back a piece of a place with him. And that's one of the neat things about Kevin Wilson's first book, is it has some of these hallmarks of place, that cocktails that you might not think about. But I wonder if you all feel the same. I mean, are there experiences you had, people who helped you make a drink, or you go, wow, I've never thought about this in that way, or the first time you had, a Pappy Van Winkle, or whatever the case may be, that will make you feel connected to place. Can you do that in the cocktail world?
Yeah, absolutely. Cocktails are really unique, and something I appreciate them for is that they are an American tradition. You know, in a relatively new country in the history of the world, so many of our traditions are borrowed and adapted, and the cocktails started in America. So Absolutely. I think that there is a sense of history with the cocktails. And, you know, in the big picture, you know, we talk about something like the Creole bitters in a Sazerac, you know, or the kinds of things we season an old fashioned with and where the cherries come from that you're going to put in your Manhattan. So in the big picture, there's that kind of history and the history of the Prohibition and the bootleggers and everything that, that the cocktails came out of that I think is really, really fascinating. And then on a smaller scale, absolutely, yeah, you travel to these great... The thing about cocktails is it goes beyond the person who made the liquor. So now you also have the personality of the person who's mixing that drink for you. A cocktail is something that is, you know, it's something that is made to order for you by somebody who's an expert in that. So really, every cocktail also has those ingredients that are made, you know, like the grapes are grown, you know, the way something mm-hmm. is distilled and aged somewhere in a certain kind of oak, etc. But now you also have the touch of the person who's making it for you. And that's kind of like somebody who cooks food for you. There's a connection there, I think. So absolutely, I learn from bartenders. I connect with bartenders.
That's such a good point. I mean, you think about a dish that you can make. Anybody could make, pick a pasta, pick a steak, but
right.
you're going to do it the way maybe your mom showed you how.
Right.
Or the way you remember a great chef or a friend. And that's like a little piece of a person.
Absolutely.
Or a place.
Yeah, I think so.
That's great. What do you think, Kat? You agree? Do you feel like there's a sense of place with cocktails?
Absolutely. And I think we're also really privileged to, you know, live in New York State where we have an amazing wine region. A lot of like cocktail history started here. There's so many amazing spirits around, a lot of rye, a lot of, you know, apple-based spirits. And I think that in terms of trends, that's also where we're moving towards. There's a bar I was reading about in D.C. where they only do ingredients you can find in sort of the tri-state area. So no sugar, because that's coming from, you know, South America. Only spirits that are sort of made and distilled in that region. And I think that that's kind of where we're going towards, is highlighting that, you know, hyper-local, basically what makes it special to be where you're at. You know, New Orleans is really great about that. They have such a strong sense of tradition, and I think New York has that too.
All right, so Chuck, as we get ready to close, about 20 seconds, you're going to hear the music, so tell people where they need to get online to learn about the Rochester Cocktail Revival.
Simply head to rochestercocktailrevival.com. All of the events are listed there. You can also, if you're more of a mobile person, you can check out the Instagram page for Rochester Cocktail Revival. Look at the featured stories. It's a visual guide to every single day of the week-long festival, and it'll give you a rundown of every single event in a visual format.
You're kicking it off next Tuesday?
Next. A few events on Monday. Officially starts Tuesday, the 1st of May. Let's go.
All right. Have fun. Thanks for being back here. Chuck Sarankowski.
Thank you.
Evie Fanning, great to see you again. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Kat Archer, nice meeting you, and thank you for being here.
Nice to meet you.
RochesterCocktailRevival.com. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. Finally, a little more sunshine, and we'll see you back here Friday on member-supported public radio.